The door opened, and the student nurse, swathed in SPGs, came in. Dunworthy looked automatically at the displays, but he couldn't see any dramatic changes. Badri was still asleep. The nurse entered some figures on the display, checked the drip, and tugged at a corner of the bedclothes. She opened the curtain, and then stood there twisting the cord in her hands. "I couldn't help overhearing you on the telephone," she said. "You mentioned a Mrs. Gadsden. I know it's terribly rude of me to ask, but might that have been William Gadsden's mother you were speaking of?"
"Yes," he said, surprised. "William's an undergraduate at Balliol. Do you know him?"
"He's a friend of mine," she said, flushing such a bright pink he could see it through her imperm mask.
"Ah,"
he said, wondering when William had time to read Petrarch.
"William's mother is here in hospital," he said, feeling he should warn her, but unclear as to whom to warn her about. "It seems she's come to visit him for Christmas."
"She's here," the nurse said, flushing an even brighter pink. "I thought we were under quarantine."
"Hers was the last train up from London," Dunworthy said wistfully.
"Does William know?"
"My secretary's attempting to notify him," he said, omitting the bit about the young lady at Shrewsbury.
"He's at the Bodleian," she said, "reading Petrarch."
She unwrapped the curtain cord from her hand and went out, no doubt to telephone the Bodleian. Badri stirred and murmured something Dunworthy could not make out. He looked flushed, and his breathing seemed more laboured. "Badri?" he said.
Badri opened his eyes. "Where am I?" he said.
Dunworthy glanced at the monitors. His fever was down a half a point, and he seemed more alert than before. "In infirmary," he said. "You collapsed in the lab at Brazenose while you were working the net. Do you remember?"
"I remember feeling odd," he said. "Cold. I came to the pub to tell you I'd got the fix."
A strange, frightened look came over his face. "You told me there was something wrong," Dunworthy said. "What was it? Was it the slippage?"
"Something wrong,"
Badri repeated. He tried to raise himself on his elbow.
"What's wrong with me?"
"You're ill," Dunworthy said. "You have the flu."
"Ill? I've never been ill."
He struggled to sit up.
"They died, didn't they?"
"Who died?"
"It killed them all."
"Did you see someone, Badri? This is important. Did someone else have the virus?"
"Virus?" he said, and there was obvious relief in his voice. "Do I have a virus?"
"Yes, a type of flu. Not fatal. They've been giving you antimicrobials and an analogue's on the way. You'll be recovered in no time. Do you know who you caught it from? Did someone else have the virus?"
"No."
He eased himself back down onto the pillow.
"I thought... Oh!"
He looked up in alarm at Dunworthy.
"There's something wrong,"
he said desperately. "What is it?" He reached for the bell. "What's wrong?"
His eyes were wide with fright.
"It hurts." Dunworthy pushed the bell. The nurse and a house officer came in immediately and went through their routine again, prodding him with the icy stethoscope. "He complained of being cold," Dunworthy said, "and of something hurting." "Where does it hurt?" the house officer said, looking at the display.
"Here,"
Badri said. He pressed his hand to the right side of his chest. He began to shiver again. Lower right pleurisy, the house officer said.
Hurts when I breathe,
Vadri said through chattering teeth.
There's something wrong.
Something wrong. He hadn't meant the fix. He had meant that something was wrong with him. He was how old? Kivrin's age? They had begun giving routine rhinovirus antivirals nearly 20 years ago. It was entirely possible that when he'd said he'd never been ill, he meant he'd never had so much as a cold. Oxygen? The nurse said.
Not yet, the house officer said on his way out. Start him on 200 units of chloramphenicol.
The nurse laid Badri back down, attached a piggyback to the drip, watched Badri's temp drop for a minute and went out. Dunworthy looked out the window at the rainy night. I remember feeling odd, he had said. Not ill. Odd. Someone who'd never had a cold wouldn't know what to make of a fever or chills. He would only have known something was wrong, and would have left the net and hurried to the pub to tell someone. Have to tell Dunworthy. Something wrong. Dunworthy took off his spectacles and rubbed his eyes. The disinfectant made them smart. He felt exhausted. He had said he couldn't relax until he knew Kivrin was all right. Badri was asleep, the harshness of his breathing taken away by the impersonal magic of the doctors. And Kivrin was asleep too, in a flea-ridden bed 700 years away. Or wide awake, impressing the contempts with her table manners and her dirty fingernails. Or kneeling on a filthy stone floor, telling her adventures into her hands. He must have dozed off. He dreamed he heard a telephone ringing. It was Finch. He told him the Americans were threatening to sue for insufficient supplies of lavatory paper and that the vicar had called with the scripture. It's Matthew 2:11, Finch said. Waste leads to want. And at that point the nurse opened the door and told him Mary needed him to meet her in casualties. He looked at his digital. It was 4:20. Badri was still asleep, looking almost peaceful. The nurse met him outside with the disinfectant bottle and told him to take the elevator. The smell of disinfectant from his spectacles helped wake him up. By the time he reached the ground floor, he was almost awake. Mary was there, waiting for him, in a mask and the rest of it. We've got another case, she said, handing him a bundle of SPGs. It's one of the detainees. It might be someone from that crowd of shoppers. I want you to try to identify her. He got into the garments as clumsily as the first time, nearly tearing the gown in his efforts to get the Velcro strips apart. There were dozens of shoppers on the high, he said, pulling the gloves on. And I was watching Badri. I doubt that I could identify anyone on that street. I know, Mary said. She led the way down the corridor and through the door to casualties. It seemed like years since he'd been there. Ahead, a cluster of people, all anonymous in paper, were wheeling a stretcher trolley in. The house officer, also papered, was taking information from a thin, frightened-looking woman in a wet Macintosh and matching rain hat. Her name is Beverly Breen, the woman told him in a faint voice. 226 Plover Way, Surbiton. I knew something was wrong. She kept saying we needed to take the tube to Northampton. She was carrying an umbrella and a large handbag, and when the house officer asked for the patient's NHS number, she leaned the umbrella against the admissions desk, opened the handbag, and looked through it. She was just brought in from the tube station, complaining of headache and chills, Mary said. She was in line to be assigned lodging. She signaled the medics to stop the stretcher trolley and pull the blanket back from the woman's neck and chest, so he could get a better look at her. But he didn't need to. The woman in the wet mac had found the card. She handed it to the officer, picked up the umbrella, the handbag, and a sheaf of varicolored papers, and came over to the stretcher trolley carrying them. The umbrella was a large one. It was covered with lavender violets. Vadri collided with her on the way back to the net, Dunworthy said.
Are you absolutely certain?
Mary said. He pointed at the woman's friend, who had sat down now and was filling out forms.
I recognize the umbrella.
What time was that? She said.
Not positive. 1:30?
What type of contact was it? Did he touch her?
He ran straight into her, he said, trying to recall the scene. He collided with the umbrella, and then he told her he was sorry, and she yelled at him for a bit. He picked up the umbrella and handed it to her.
Did he cough or sneeze?
I can't remember.
The woman was being wheeled into casualties. Mary stood up.
I want her put in isolation, she said, and started after them.
The woman's friend stood up, dropping one of the forms and clutching the others awkwardly to her chest.
Isolation? She said frightenedly. What's wrong with her?
Come with me, please, Mary said to her, and led her off somewhere to have her blood taken and her friend's umbrella spritzed with disinfectant, before Dunworthy could ask her whether she wanted him to wait for her. He started to ask the registrar, and then sat down, tiredly, in one of the chairs against the wall. There was an inspirational brochure on the chair next to him. Its title was, The Importance of a Good Night's Sleep. His neck hurt from his uncomfortable sleep on the camp stool, and his eyes were smarting again. He supposed he should go back up to Badri's room, but he wasn't certain he had the energy to put on another set of SPGs. And he didn't think he could bear to wake Badri and ask him who else would be shortly wheeled into casualties with a temp of 39.5. At any rate, Kivrin wouldn't be one of them. It was 4:30. Badri had collided with the woman with the lavender umbrella at 1:30. That meant an incubation of 15 hours. And 15 hours ago, Kivrin had been fully protected. Mary came back, her cap off and her mask dangling from her neck. Her hair was in disarray, and she looked as bone-weary as Dunworthy felt. I'm discharging Mrs. Gadsden, she told the registrar. She's to be back here at 7 for a blood test.
She came over to where Dunworthy was sitting.
I'd forgotten all about her, she said, smiling. She was rather upset. She threatened to sue me for unlawful detainment.
She should get along well with my bell ringers. They're threatening to go to court over involuntary breach of contract.
Mary ran her hand through her disorderly hair. We got an ident from the World Influenza Center on the influenza virus. She stood up as if she had had a sudden infusion of energy. I could do with a cup of tea, she said. Come along. Dunworthy glanced at the registrar, who was watching them attentively, and hauled himself to his feet.
I'll be in the surgical waiting room, Mary said to the registrar.
Yes, doctor, the registrar said. I couldn't help overhearing your conversation, she said, hesitantly. Mary stiffened. You told me you were discharging Mrs. Gadsden, and then I heard you mention the name William. And I was just wondering if Mrs. Gadsden is by any chance William Gadsden's mother.
Yes, Mary said, looking puzzled. You're a friend of his,
Dunworthy said, wondering if she would blush like the blonde student nurse. She did. I've come to know him rather well this back. He stayed up to read Petrarch.
Among other things, Dunworthy said,
and while she was busy blushing, steered Mary past the no-entrance isolation area sign and down the corridor.
What in heaven's name was that all about? She asked.
Sickly William is even more self-sufficient than we had at first assumed, he said, and opened the door to the waiting room.
Mary flicked the light on and went over to the tea trolley. She shook the electric kettle and disappeared into the WC with it. He sat down. Someone had taken away the tray of blood-testing equipment and moved the end table back to its proper place.
but Mary's shopping bag was still sitting in the middle of the floor. He leaned forward and moved it over next to the chairs. Mary reappeared with the kettle. She bent and plugged it in.
"Did you have any luck discovering Badri's contacts?" she said.
"If you could call it that. He went to a Christmas dance in Headington last night. He took the tube both ways. How bad is it?"
Mary opened two tea packets and draped them over the cups. "There's only powdered milk, I'm afraid. Do you know if he's had any contact recently with someone from the States?"
"No. Why?"
"Do you take sugar?"
"How bad is it?"
She poured powdered milk into the cups.
"The bad news is that Badri's very ill." She spooned in sugar. "He had his seasonal through the university, which requires broader spectrum protection than the NHS. He should be completely protected against a 5-point shift and partially resistant to a 10-point shift. But he's exhibiting full influenza symptoms, which indicates a major mutation."
The kettle was screaming.
"Which means an epidemic."
"Yes."
"A pandemic?"
"Possibly.
If the WIC can't sequence the virus quickly, or the staff bolts, or the quarantine doesn't hold."
She unplugged the kettle and poured hot water into their cups.
"The good news is that the WIC thinks it's an influenza that originated in South Carolina."
She brought a cup over to Dunworthy.
"In which case, it's already been sequenced and an analogue and vaccine manufactured. It responds well to antimicrobials and symptomatic treatment, and it's not fatal."
"How long is its incubation period?"
12 to 48 hours.
She stood against the tea trolley and took a sip of tea.
"The WIC is sending blood samples to the CDC in Atlanta for matching, and they're sending their recommended course of treatment."
"When did Kivrin check into infirmary on Monday for antivirals?"
3 o'clock,
Mary said.
"She was here until 9 the next morning. I kept her overnight to ensure she's got a good night's sleep."
"Badri says he didn't see her yesterday," Dunworthy said. "But he could have had contact with her Monday before she went into infirmary."
"She'd need to have been exposed before her antiviral inoculation. And the virus have had a chance to replicate unchecked for her to be in danger, James," Mary said. "Even if she did see Badri Monday or Tuesday, she's in less danger of developing symptoms than you are."
She looked seriously at him over her teacup.
"You're still worried over the fix, aren't you?"
He half shook his head.
"Badri says he checked the apprentice's coordinates and they were correct, and he'd already told Gilchrist the slippage was minimal," he said, wishing Badri had answered him when he asked him about the slippage.
"What else is there that can have gone wrong?" Mary asked.
"I don't know. Nothing. Except that she's alone in the Middle Ages."
Mary set her cup of tea down on the trolley.
"She may be safer there than here.
We're going to have a good many ill patients. Influenza spreads like wildfire, and the quarantine will only make it worse. The medical staff are always the first exposed. If they come down with it, or the supply of antimicrobials gives out, this century could be the one that's a 10.
She pushed her hand tiredly over her untidy hair.
"Sorry. It's the fatigue speaking. This isn't the Middle Ages, after all. It's not even the 20th century. We have metabolizers and adjuvants. And if it's the South Carolina virus, we've an analogue and a vaccine. But I'm still glad Colin and Kivrin are safely out of this."
"Safely in the Middle Ages," Dunworthy said.
Mary smiled at him.
"With the cutthroats."
The door banged open. A tallish blonde boy with large feet and a rugby duffel came in, dripping water on the floor.
"Colin," Mary said.
"So this is where you've got to," Colin said. "I've been looking everywhere for you."
Transcript from the Doomsday Book. Mr. Dunworthy. Ad adjuvandum me festina. Make haste to help me. Book 2. In the bleak midwinter, frosty wind made moan. Earth stood hard as iron, water like a stone. Snow had fallen, snow on snow, snow on snow. In the bleak midwinter, long ago. Christina Rossetti. Chapter 10. The fire was out. Kivrin could still smell smoke in the room, but she knew it was from a fire burning in a hearth somewhere. It's no wonder, she thought. Chimneys didn't become extant in England until the late 14th century, and this is only 1320. And as soon as she had formed the thought, awareness of the rest of it came. I am in 1320, and I've been ill. I've had a fever. For a while, she didn't think any further than that. It was peaceful just to lie there and rest. She felt worn out, as if she had come through some terrible ordeal that took all her strength. I thought they were trying to burn me at the stake, she thought. She remembered struggling against them and the flames leaping up, licking at her hands, burning her hair. They had to cut off my hair, she thought, and wondered if that were a memory or something she had dreamed. She was too tired to raise her hand to her hair, too tired to even try to remember. I have been very ill, she thought. They gave me the last rites. There is naught to fear, he had said. You do but go home again. Requiescat in pace, and slept. When she woke again, it was dark in the room, and a bell was ringing a long way off. She had the idea that it had been ringing for a long time, the way the lone bell had rung when she came through. But after a minute, another one chimed in, and then one so close, it seemed to be just outside the window, drowning out the others as they rang. Matins, Kivrin thought, and seemed to remember them ringing like that before, a ragged, out-of-tune chiming that matched the beating of her heart. But that was impossible. She must have dreamed it. She had dreamed they were burning her at the stake. She had dreamed they cut off her hair. She had dreamed the contempt spoke a language she didn't understand. The nearest bell stopped, and the others went on for a while, as if glad of the opportunity to make themselves heard. And Kivrin remembered that, too. How long had she been here? It had been night, and now it was morning. It seemed like one night, but now she remembered the faces leaning over her, when the woman had brought her the cup, and again when the priest had come in and the cutthroat with him. She had been able to see them clearly, without the flicker of unsteady candle light. And in between she remembered darkness, and the smoky light of tallow lamps and the bells, ringing and stopping and ringing again. She felt a sudden stab of panic. How long had she been lying here? What if she had been ill for weeks, and had already missed the rendezvous? But that was impossible. People weren't delirious for weeks, even if they had typhoid fever. And she couldn't have typhoid fever. She had had her inoculations. It was cold in the room, as if the fire had gone out in the night. She felt for the bed coverings, and hands came up out of the dark immediately and pulled something soft over her shoulders. Thank you, Kivrin said, and slept. The cold woke her again, and she had the feeling she had only slept a few moments, though there was a little light in the room now. It came from a narrow window recessed in the stone wall. The window's shutters had been opened, and that was where the cold was coming from, too. A woman was standing on tiptoe on the stone seat under the window, fastening a cloth over the opening. She was wearing a black robe and a white wimple and coif, and for a moment, Kivrin thought, I'm in a nunnery. And then remembered that women in the 1300s covered their hair when they were married. Only unmarried girls wore their hair loose and uncovered. The woman didn't look old enough to be married, or to be a nun either. There had been a woman in the room while she was ill, but that woman had been much older. When Kivrin had clutched at her hands in her delirium, they had been rough and wrinkled, and the woman's voice had been harsh with age, though perhaps that had been part of the delirium too. The woman leaned into the light from the window. The white coif was yellowed, and it was not a robe, but a kirtle like Kivrin's, with a dark green surcoat over it. It was badly dyed, and looked like it had been made from a burlap sack, the weave so large Kivrin could see it easily, even in the dim light. She must be a servant, then. But servants didn't wear linen wimples or carry bunches of keys like the one that hung from the woman's belt. She had to be a person of some importance. The housekeeper, perhaps. And this was a place of importance. Probably not a castle, because the wall the bed lay up against wasn't stone. It was unfinished wood. But very likely a manor house of at least the first order of nobility, a minor baron, and possibly higher than that. The bed she was lying in was a real bed, with a raised wooden frame and hangings and stiff linen sheets, not just a pallet, and the coverings were fur. The stone seat under the window had embroidered cushions on it. The woman tied the cloth to little projections of stone on either side of the narrow window, stepped down from the window seat, and leaned over to get something. Kivrin couldn't see what it was because the bed hangings obstructed her view. They were heavy, almost like rugs, and had been pulled back and tied with what looked like rope. The woman straightened up again, holding a wooden bowl, and then, catching her skirts up with her free hand, stepped onto the window seat and began brushing something thick onto the cloth. Oil, Kivrin thought. No, wax. Waxed linen used in place of glass in windows. Glass was supposed to have been common in 14th century manor houses. The nobility were supposed to have carried glass windows along with the luggage and the furniture when they travelled from house to house. I must get this on the corder, Kivrin thought, that some manor houses didn't have glass windows. And she raised her hands and pressed them together, but the effort of holding them up was too great, and she let them fall back onto the coverings. The woman glanced over toward the bed, and then turned back to the window, and went on painting the cloth with long, unconcerned strokes. I must be getting better, Kivrin thought. She was right by the bed the whole time I was ill. She wondered again how long that time had been. I will have to find out, she thought, and then I must find the drop. It couldn't be very far. If this was the village she had intended to go to, the drop wasn't more than a mile away. She tried to remember how long the trip to the village had taken. It had seemed to take a long time. The cutthroat had put her on a white horse, and it had had bells on its harness. But he wasn't a cutthroat. He was a kind-looking young man with red hair. She would have to ask the name of the village she had been brought to, and hopefully it would be Skengate. But even if it wasn't, she would know from the name where she was in relation to the drop. And, of course, as soon as she was a little stronger, they could show her where it was. What is the name of this village you have brought me to? She had not been able to think of the words last night, but that was because of the fever, of course. She had no trouble now. Mr. Latimer had spent months on her pronunciation. They would certainly be able to understand in what alone am e, or even what be this holding. And even if there was some variation in local dialect, the interpreter would automatically correct it. What a place hast thou brought her, May? Kivrin said. The woman turned, looked startled. She stepped down from the window seat, still holding the bowl in one hand and the brush in the other. Only it wasn't a brush, Kivrin could see as she approached the bed. It was a squarish wooden spoon with a nearly flat bowl. Got a bit place, our flavour, the woman said, holding spoon and bowl together in front of her. Listen out, Augusta. The interpreter was supposed to translate what was said immediately. Maybe Kivrin's pronunciation was all off. So far off that the woman thought she was speaking a foreign language and was trying to answer her in clumsy French or German. What a place hast thou brought me? She said slowly, so the interpreter would have time to translate what she said. With London be ye common la dauka, a tringo the lay de schnorm and thou six strangolanders. Spickle for equanot of the talud breda.
Lay us charis lusty, a voice said.
The woman turned around to look at the door. Kivrin couldn't see. And another woman came in, much older. Her face under the coif wrinkled, and her hands, the hands Kivrin remembered from her delirium, rough and old. She was wearing a silver chain and carrying a small leather chest. It looked like the casket Kivrin had brought through with her, but it was smaller and bound with iron instead of brass. She set the casket down on the window seat.
Thou speckere, demet.
She remembered the voice, too, harsh and almost angry sounding, speaking to the woman by Kivrin's bed as if she were a servant. Well, perhaps she was. And this was the lady of the house, though her coif was no whiter, her dress no finer. But there weren't any keys at her belt. And now Kivrin remembered that it wasn't the housekeeper who carried the keys, but the lady of the house. The lady of the manor, in yellowed linen and badly dyed burlap, which meant that Kivrin's dress was all wrong as Latimer's pronunciations. As wrong as Dr. Aron's assurances that she would not get any medieval diseases.
I had my inoculations,
she murmured. And both women turned to look at her.
Eliva, what word is your fiendinist?
The older woman asked sharply. Was she the younger woman's mother? Or her mother-in-law? Or her nurse? Kivrin had no idea. None of the words she'd said, not even a proper name or a form of address, separated itself out.
Me tinkle wan the host wakes a hildumla,
the younger woman said, and the older one answered,
No, neither behoes deruta.
Nothing. Shorter sentences were supposed to be easier to translate, so Kivrin couldn't even tell whether she had said one word or several. The younger woman's chin in the tight coif lifted angrily.
Sir Tesson, Shidavnum, Volda de Rai Serios,
she said sharply. Kivrin wondered if they were arguing over what to do with her. She pushed on the coverlet with her weak hands, as if she could push herself away from them, and the young woman set down her bowl and spoon and came immediately up beside the bed.
Spagan your vote agon, Liz,
she said. And it might be good morning, or are you feeling better, or we're burning you at dawn, for all Kivrin knew. Perhaps her illness was keeping the interpreter from working. Perhaps when the fever went down, she would understand everything they said. The old woman knelt beside the bed, holding a small silver box at the end of the chain between her folded hands, and began to pray. The young woman leaned forward to look at Kivrin's forehead, and then reached around behind her head, doing something that pulled at Kivrin's hair. And she realized they must have bandaged the wound on her forehead. She touched her hand to the cloth, and then put it on her neck, feeling for her tangled locks. But there was nothing there. Her hair ended in a ragged fringe just below her ears.
"We mustn't be a tyrant," the young woman said worriedly. "For the hound wants sore."
She was giving Kivrin some kind of explanation, though Kivrin couldn't understand it. And actually, she did understand it. She had been very ill, so ill she had thought her hair was on fire. She remembered someone, the old woman, trying to grab at her hands and her flailing wildly at the flames. They had had no alternative. And Kivrin had hated the unwieldy mass of hair and the endless time it took to brush it. Had worried about how medieval women wore their hair, whether they braided it or not, and wondered how on earth she was going to get through 2 weeks without washing it. She should be glad they'd cut it off, but all she could think of was Joan of Arc, who had had short hair, whom they had burned at the stake. The young woman had drawn her hands back from the bandage and was watching Kivrin, looking frightened. Kivrin smiled at her, a little quaveringly, and she smiled back. She had a gap where two teeth were missing on the right side of her mouth, and the tooth next to the gap was brown. But when she smiled, she looked no older than a first-year student. She finished untying the bandage and laid it on the coverlet. It was the same yellowed linen as her coif, but torn into fraying strips and stained with brownish blood. There was more blood than Kivrin would have thought there would be. Mr. Gilchrist's wound must have started bleeding again. The woman touched Kivrin's temple nervously, as if she wasn't sure what to do.
"Yek si yohankut,"
she said, and put one hand behind Kivrin's neck and helped her raise her head. Her head felt terribly light. "That must be because of my hair," Kivrin thought. The older woman handed the young one a wooden bowl, and she put it to Kivrin's lips. Kivrin sipped carefully at it, thinking confusedly that it was the same bowl that had held the wax. It wasn't. And it wasn't the drink they'd given her before. It was a thin, grainy gruel, less bitter than the drink last night, with a greasy aftertaste.
"Thus hold the naive gross vitale traweta," the older woman said, her voice harsh with impatient criticism.
Definitely her mother-in-law, Kivrin thought.
"Chimota lesa huafuaf,"
the young woman answered back mildly. The gruel tasted good. Kivrin tried to drink it all, but after only a few sips she felt worn out. The young woman handed the bowl to the older one, who had come around to the side of the bed too, and eased Kivrin's head back down onto the pillow. She picked up the bloody bandage, touched Kivrin's temple again as if she were debating whether to put the bandage back on again, and then handed it to the other woman, who set it and the bowl down on the chest that must be at the foot of the bed.
"Lo ligach di alawa," the young woman said, smiling her gap-toothed smile, and there was no mistaking her tone, even though she couldn't make out the words at all.
The woman had told her to go to sleep. She closed her eyes.
"Der Mädel shall ausbrich niawa,"
the older woman said, and they left the room, shutting the heavy door behind them. Kivrin repeated the words slowly to herself, trying to catch some familiar word. The interpreter was supposed to enhance her ability to separate out phonemes and recognize syntactical patterns, not just store Middle English vocabulary. But she might as well be listening to Serbo-Croatian. "And maybe I am," she thought. "Who knows where they brought me? I was delirious. Maybe the cutthroat put me on a boat and took me across the channel." She knew that wasn't possible. She remembered most of the night's journey, even though it had a disjointed, dreamlike quality to it.
"I fell off the horse," she thought, and a red-headed man picked me up, and we came past a church. She frowned, trying to remember more about the direction they had travelled. They had headed into the woods away from the thicket, and then came to a road, and the road forked, and that was where she had fallen off. If she could find the fork in the road, perhaps she could find the drop from there. The fork was only a little way from the tower. But if the drop was that close, she was in Skengate, and the women were speaking Middle English. But if they were speaking Middle English, why couldn't she understand them? Maybe I hit my head when I fell off the horse, and it's done something to the interpreter, she thought. But she had not hit her head. She had let go and slid down until she was sitting on the road. It's the fever, she thought. It's somehow keeping the interpreter from recognizing the words. It recognized the Latin, she thought, and a little knot of fear began to form in her chest. It recognized the Latin, and I can't be ill. I had my inoculations. She remembered suddenly that her antiviral inoculation had itched and made a lump under her arm, but Dr. Ahrens had checked it just before she came through. Dr. Ahrens had said it was all right, and none of her other inoculations had itched except the plague inoculation. I can't have the plague, she thought. I don't have any of the symptoms. Plague victims had huge lumps under their arms and on the insides of their thighs. They vomited blood, and the blood vessels under their skin ruptured and turned black. It wasn't the plague. But what was it? And how had she contracted it? She had been inoculated against every major disease extant in 1320. And anyway, she hadn't been exposed to any disease. She had begun to have symptoms as soon as she came through, before she had even met anyone. Germs didn't just hover near a drop, waiting for someone to come through. They had to be spread by contact or sneezing or fleas. The plague had been spread by fleas. It's not the plague, she told herself firmly. People who have the plague don't wonder if they have it. They're too busy dying. It wasn't the plague. The fleas that had spread it lived on rats and humans, not out in the middle of a forest. And the Black Death hadn't reached England till 1348. It must be some medieval disease Dr. Ahrens hadn't known about. There had been all sorts of strange diseases in the Middle Ages. The King's Evil and St. Vitus's Dance and unnamed fevers. It must be one of them. And it had taken her enhanced immune system a while to figure out what it was and begin fighting it. But now it had, and her temperature was down, and the interpreter would begin working. All she had to do was rest and wait and get better. Comforted by that thought, she closed her eyes again and slept.
This ends side 2 of cassette 4 of Doomsday Book. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 5.